All right, it's me, and I want to thank everyone at the Oasis Podcast, as you were.
In 3 years, Oasis will have gone from being a new signing to one of rock's true giants.
What happened to you in those 3 years? So that's a big question.
It is a big question. And it deserves a big answer.
We were just lads from a council estate. Two brothers.
No, it's the funny farm.
Head cases.
Come, you balls!
Nobody had heard of us, but we had spirit.
We never gave up. One night, everything changed.
There is a story about you getting signed to Creation. Alan McGee saw you in the club, is that right?
I did, yeah. He signed us there and then on the spot.
No one had ever come along that was even remotely like us.
Their debut album is already the classic of our time.
Then it just blew up.
The most popular rock and roll band in Britain today.
Oasis were involved in a drunken brawl.
Immediately condemned by politicians.
The day that it steps over into the tabloids, then you've gone to the dark side.
Trouble seemed to find us.
It all happened too quick.
Oasis was like a Ferrari. Great to look at, great to drive, and it'll fucking spin out of control every now and again.
Oasis's greatest strength was me and Liam. It's also what drove the band into the ground in the end.
Give it up for Oasis.
One of the biggest bands since the Beatles.
It just caught fire
all over the world. Dance if they wanna dance.
It was just a great time to be alive.
It was fucking biblical, man. I'd do it all again in that beat.
Sometimes I wish it had gone a different way, but it hasn't.
I just think in the times in which we live, it would be unrepeatable.
If this ever goes on like a video, I would apologise, but I'm not going to, because he's a prick.
Hello and welcome back to the Oasis Podcast, the ultimate audio guide to Oasis. And the reason for playing the full Supersonic trailer there, I couldn't just play 30 seconds of it, I had to play the whole thing, is because joining me on the podcast today is the brilliant Matt Whitecross, director of Supersonic, as well as a bunch of other films. And yeah, it's very exciting, and I'm very much looking forward to you guys hearing the interview. It's been a long time in the making. I originally sort of contacted Matt right when I first started the podcast. He was one of the first people that I got in contact with, and it's just taken a little while to sort of put these things together. He was flying around doing loads of stuff for the Coldplay film that then followed Supersonic. So yeah, he's been a busy man to get hold of, but we managed to make it happen. And ironically, I had to call the episode a bit short because I had to leg it, because that day I was going off to interview Alan McGee. So so that was quite a crazy day. But anyway, so it's a really good interview. I hope you guys enjoy it. There's shed loads more to talk about. And as you'll hear in it, Matt said he's definitely happy to come on again. So we shall hopefully do it again sometime. But before we get into that, let's just pick up on the news once again. It's not a huge amount of news because it's only been a few days really since I last recorded. The main thing is that Liam has announced a huge outdoor gig in Cork. This is at Irish Independent Park on June 23rd. Tickets go on sale this Friday coming at 8:30, so make sure you guys are checking that out. Noel has booked to play in South Korea in May at the Olympic Hall. And Noel Gallagher went on Football Focus and sat down with Gary Lineker and Vincent Kompany. So let's have a little bit of that.
There was a time, probably, Noel, that Oasis was far more known around the world than Manchester City.
That's probably fair to say.
Possibly changed in recent times.
But. One would hope so, yeah. I mean, I was in Japan last year for the first home game of the season, and we just happened to amble into a... We was in Osaka, in Japan. We happened to amble into a bar, and it was full of City fans. but not English City fans. It was full of Japanese City fans.
You turned into Manchester United.
Well, God forbid. But we were like, you know, in this back street in Osaka, and they all had City kits on, and they were sitting, and we were like, wow, this is, you know, this is the start of something. But I guess there was a time when, well, Oasis would fill Main Road. You know, but it just goes to show that if you get the right people involved in a football club and you're measured in what you do, you can make great things happen.
Can you see similarities between music and football?
Of course.
Such as?
All musicians. Yeah. I've never met a musician who was any good that didn't want to be a footballer.
Would you sooner be a footballer than a musician?
Probably earn more money than me now, so I'd probably say yes. I'd rather
be.
You can do it for life.
Well, you know,
we don't get royalties.
Would you swap?
Well, it's a different thing. Vinny represents an entire city, yeah. And when he goes out onto the pitch, he represents an entire club. And if he makes a mistake, you know, people's weekends are ruined. Mm. With music, it's different. You're part of a person's night out, but you're still performing in front of big crowds, you know.
And just a reminder that the tickets are still on sale for the Oasis Podcast live event, which is at the Water Rats, King's Cross, London. Live interview on stage with Tony McCarroll, plus a Q&A, live music and DJs through till 1 a.m. So make sure you head over to my social media, or check the link in the notes of this episode, or if you just Google Tony McCarroll live Oasis podcast, I think it's the first thing that comes up. So yeah, make sure you check that out. We're about halfway there, and we've still got whatever it is, over 3 months to go. So it will sell out. You're not going to be able to wait until the last minute. I've got quite a lot of people saying, oh, I'm not sure, can you hold tickets for me? There's not that many left. There's only like 100 left. So if you are thinking of coming, please do get yourself tickets. I'm not going to be able to sort people out last minute. It just can't happen. The capacity is only 200. So it's just, it'll be a fire hazard. But yeah, so I do really look forward to seeing a lot of you guys there. So coming up after the interview, we have got quite a few messages to play to you and an international flavour to them today. We've got Grandpa Batman has sent me a message all the way from Texas. We've got one from the author Tim Woods, who's in Berlin, Robert Fan, who's in Brazil, and also I've got a bit of something to play for you from Brandon Arendt in Los Angeles. So we will get to that in a bit, but without further ado, I'm going to hand over to me talking to the brilliant Matt Whitecross. Welcome to the Oasis Podcast, Matt Whitecross. How the hell are you?
Thank you very much. I'm good. I'm very good. I'm sleep deprived. I've been playing Florence Nightingale for our kids all night, but otherwise we're all good. Thank you.
Well, that should make for an interesting interview. That would be good fun.
I might not say what I mean.
It might start rambling stream of consciousness or something. That'd be fantastic.
Yeah, we'll mean what I say.
So you're going to take your Coldplay hat off and put your Oasis hat back on. Is that all right?
Yeah, absolutely. It feels like a very, very long time ago. It feels about as long ago as Nebworth. But yes, if I'm a little bit flaky with the answers, I'm not being evasive. I just can't remember my name at the moment.
No, that's fine. Well, firstly, congratulations on, obviously on A Head Full of Dreams as well, but you know, this is the Oasis podcast. So congratulations on Supersonic.
Thank you so much.
Everyone, you know, from the Oasis fandom, is pretty much unanimous that it's an absolutely brilliant piece of work. Captures That's the spirit sweet. Of what they're about. You know what I mean? And this is, for me, it came out at the same, around the same time as the Ron Howard Beatles film. And right. And it was like, and so to me, it was a real clear comparison. That had certain issues. I didn't think it did capture what it was trying to. This did exactly what we wanted it to. And you know, everything with the use of animation and the fact it was pure voiceover rather than, you know, someone now sitting in a room, you know what I mean? All that sort of stuff. I just think
there was sort of pretty much no choices in the way you put it together and things like that that, that most fans would say, you know, could have done better. So congratulations.
You're very sweet. Thank you. Thank you so much. It's lovely of you to say it, because it's funny, we, you know, I think all filmmakers work in a bit of a bubble, and especially on the low budget indie British side of things, it's really just four of us in a room most of the time, sometimes just two of us in a room. And it was real labour of love. We all loved the band and we wanted to try and do them justice. And you're beavering away for, you know, for not that long, actually. We really kind of, we knew we had to try and hit this deadline. Noel was adamant it had to be out in time for the Nebworth anniversary. So we just crashed into it. And yeah, and then when you kind of, it's a bit, it must be a little bit like leaving your kids at school gates. It's like, well, you know, please be nice to them. Just, you know, we really love them. Don't do us anything mean. And it felt a little bit like that. You know, you just kind of hand it over to other people. And luckily people seem to respond really well. I try not to read any critics, just because you'll sit there arguing against, you know, with a newspaper or a magazine. It's not very useful. I've done it in the past and it never really ended very well. I only believe the bad stuff. Mm. But it's actually been really lovely to connect with fans of the band and people who've seen the film, and that part of the process I really love. I mean, doing something like this, for example, it is very different, because we can have a back and forth and you can say something that you liked or disliked and we can argue it out. But I think sometimes when I'm in the past and I've been reading criticism, and often, especially if the criticism is valid, then you kind of implode a bit. So, yeah, thank you very much.
That's all right. Well, the only criticism I'd have is that it ends at Nebworth. You know what I mean?
Right.
And
I
completely understand that choice, because by having it end at Nebworth, you have this, you know, you do get the chance to explore certain parts of the story that, if you're doing the full life of the band, you probably have to cut out. So all the lovely sure. little parts, like the, you know, Noel's little sojourn when he went off and wrote Talk Tonight and things like that, or the, you know, the whiskey gig and things, you probably wouldn't have fitted that in if all you were doing is hitting, okay, we got to hit Earl's Court, we got to hit Nebworth, we got to... If you're just hitting the big things, you don't have the opportunity for that, is the impression I get. So, yeah, so... And also, you know, the rise is typically the most exciting part. You know, I completely sure. get that. But was that always the choice to end at Nebworth?
Pretty early on. I mean, it's interesting. How the thing came about was, so I had this project that I was really hoping to do, which was a drama about the miners' strike. And we were trying to get it up and running, and we'd been doing it for about 5 years. And then we kind of had, as seems to happen on a lot of projects, you get a regime change at whichever channel or whatever, you know, studio it is. And suddenly it was like it had fallen out of favour. And I got this text from Simon Halfon, who I'd met in the past, and we talked about doing different projects. He worked in the music industry for a long time as a designer, and he designed a lot of the sleeves and a lot of the artwork for Oasis later on, after Brian Cannon had gone off to do other things. So I met him and I knew him, but I hadn't heard from him for years. And then he texted me just saying, are you an Oasis fan? And I was thinking, well, so what's it? Are they getting back together? What's the thing? So I was like, yeah, of course, you know. And then he said, well, you know, they want to do something. Noel wants to do something, but he doesn't know what it is. And he wants to, you know, we've got all these anniversaries that are coming up very soon. And they want to kind of commemorate it and commemorate them in some way. They haven't quite figured out what. They've got a bunch of footage, for example, from Nebworth, which no one's really seen, or it's been bits of it have leaked online, but I don't think people have really seen it. So that might be one way of doing it, you know. So we kind of talked about, could it just be a concert thing, is it? And so we just spoke over the phone about it, and I just said, you know, I'd read something recently, possibly about the Beatles, or I can't remember which band, but basically saying that, you know, bands are unique on their way up, but then bands, they kind of become all this, it's the same story after that, you know. You basically do tour album, you fall out with each other, you sleep with each other's girlfriends, you all get addicted to heroin, and then that's it, and they end up in court, kind of thing. So I was like, okay, well, that's to me seems an interesting way in. And I kind of sounded him out. I was like, how realistic is this? Is this going to happen? He's like, honestly, I've absolutely no idea. But he was friends with Noel, friends with Liam as well, friends with a lot of the band. And he was like, look, why don't we just go in? We'll sound them out. We'll have a chat. Worst comes to the worst, you've met Noel, which I've, you know, one of the bucket list things. I was like, you're right. Let's just get into a room and then we'll have a chat. And so I went in without much of a plan, but I thought, well, it's their project, so they'll tell us what they want, and then we can tell, you know, we can meet in the middle somewhere. And the first thing Noel said was like, yeah, so what's this project you're doing? So I was like, oh, fuck, I'm supposed to be selling it to them.
You tell me.
And so
mate.
I kind of... Well, exactly. It was a bit of that. But I just said, you know, I kind of more or less said what we'd said, which was just that, like, it just seems to me that that particular story, the rise to Nebworth, is so meteoric and happens so quickly. And yes, okay, maybe it follows the template set by the Beatles, but it was so fast. There's no contemporary bands to Oasis that achieved anything in that amount of time. You know, I don't think there's very few people, bands worldwide.
Somebody suggested that the next thing we should do should be these things at Nebworth. They didn't really have much significance to me. But, you know, somebody's only got a whisper in my ear. Oh, these are the biggest gigs of all time. And I guess, well, that's me, yeah. Thank you. You've just sold it to me. Thank you very much.
The giant stage lies dark and silent. Tomorrow, that'll be the focus for 250,000 people. Do you know, over 4% of the population applied for tickets for Oasis. 4% of the population. In just over 3 years, Oasis will have gone from being a new signing to one of rock's true giants.
You know, everyone was taking a big leap of faith that we were going to sell these shows out. And the first one, I think, went on sale. It, like, sold out in, like, minutes.
As if by magic, the sun's got his hat on.
The idea was put to us, we should put another two nights on sale immediately. And I think for the first time ever, we kind of backed away. Don't know, maybe we got the sense it had become too big. And you find out afterwards that we could have done seven nights.
Can't believe that we only done two nights. Whose fucking great idea was that? We should still be there playing right now.
And finally, it's been called the rock concert of the decade. 250,000 rock fans at Nebworth in Hertfordshire.
In a few hours, the hype becomes reality when Oasis take to the stage.
John, describe the scene for us.
I do often think, what was it all about? When we got to Nebworth, we'd only just become rock stars. And I said to Coily and Phil, you're getting on that helicopter, because they were our two oldest mates. Really, you should be there to see it with us, this thing that we're all part of. It did feel like the end of something as opposed to the beginning of something. I had a sense of that, even at Nebworth, do you know what I mean? That it was never going to happen again.
So that feels to me, it's like, if that's the snapshot you really want to try and do. And he's like, no, it was much longer than 2 years, I'm sure. Have another look. No, honestly, he was like, I remember he said something along the lines of, I've been at parties that lasted longer than that. He was like, no, there's no way it's 2 years. I was like, honestly, so I think maybe that's the way to do it. Because I said, you know, I mean, obviously we've just done it with Coldplay, but it wasn't easy. How do you condense 20 years into 2 hours? It's impossible. How do you condense 2 years into 2 hours?
Sure.
That's more or less impossible. So when we did that first pass at it, I kind of knew, we had this footage of Nebworth, and I kind of knew that's possibly where we wanted to start and end. And that was kind of the game plan, with the proviso that if, as we went along, we realised that that wasn't enough or it didn't quite work, then we'd revisit it. And that was kind of it. So we went into it just with that. And like you say, there was something so exciting about that moment in time, not just for the band, but, you know, it felt like it was full of possibilities in a way that we seem to be living in an almost kind of like a mirror image of that now, where everything seems to be fucked and falling apart. Not that it necessarily is. I think there is hope, but it feels that way if you read the papers every day.
Yeah.
And similarly with the music industry and film, everyone's like, oh, you know, nothing's possible. We can't get anything made anymore. Nothing interesting. And it's not true, but it's harder in different ways. So that's kind of what attracted me to it. But I you know, I really, it was just to get in a room with Noel.
To meet Noel Gallagher.
At the very least, I've met him, shook his hand, and that would be it. I didn't necessarily expect there'd be a film at the end of it.
Sure. And what about your history with the band? So I think we're a similar age. So you were kind of mid-90s. Was the big Britpop revelation for you in sort of your early teens? Is it that similar story?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, yeah, I think it's like, it's inevitable. If you grew up at that time, then that was just part of your life and part of the way you were and part of the way you dressed and the people you hung out with so you'd go to those kinds of gigs. I didn't get to go to Nebworth, but I grew up in Oxford, so I'd go to the Zodiac, which was over in East Oxford.
Yeah, I'm an Oxford boy as well. I grew up to gigs on the Cowley Road, so yeah, absolutely.
There you go, yeah. Right, exactly. So I would go and see bands there. I mean, lots of international bands, but I loved going to see Radiohead and Supergrass there. And so I had, and other bands, I think I'd see Ride there and a bunch of other bands. So there was a good scene. And so I was kind of, you know, and I was into music, but I was into quite, I was probably quite pretentious and always wanting to be into music that other people weren't into. So as soon as something became successful, I had to kind of move on. And I think I've gradually evolved to be a bit more gregarious and a bit more kind of eclectic in my taste, and a bit more, also just a bit, you know, I'd like a bit less sniffy with, sniffy about success, I suppose, and sniffy about, you know, kind of popular culture. Because I think I loved when Definitely Maybe came out, you know, we played that and played it and played it, and that was the soundtrack to that whole year. And then, but then they became, then it became a big hit. And then it's like, oh, can you be into something that's a hit? And I think luckily I was surrounded by a lot of people, not least the Coldplay guys, who were just like, this, what's wrong with people liking something?
Exactly.
Like, no, I'm going to go and find something that everyone hates. You know? And I think, so they were, you know, we used to play that on rotation. And yeah, so it was like 100%. I didn't go and see them until the third album, though.
Really?
I have no idea why. I think, yeah, I don't know why. We used to go to a lot of gigs, but I just never really got the chance. And it's expensive to go to gigs as well. And for whatever reason, it never kind of landed. I think I was away. I was out of the country when Nebworth was going on.
Right. And they got big very quick as well. You know, that sort of, you know, but as soon as Definitely Maybe comes out, it's not like there was 4 or 5 tours in pretty small venues. You know, once Definitely comes out, it did jump up pretty quick. So it is then up to the.
Yeah.
So if you're more of a, yeah, I'll get to see them if it's a couple of thousand, you know, or 500 sort of venue, then yeah, then they were pretty much, you know, it was so meteoric. But I'll tell you a little story on, you know, sort of my experience of seeing Coldplay for the only time, actually, only time I saw them. I was at uni in Leicester, and they played they played the De Montfort Union in about 2000 or 2001.
Right, at the beginning.
Yeah, and I liked them. I liked them, but they weren't, you know, they weren't my favourite band. I really liked Don't Panic. I remember thinking that's like one of the best songs of the year. And then, but it's at that point in the uni where you kind of know everyone. I knew the guy on the door. I knew the guy behind the bar. And then they said, oh, yeah, Coldplay are playing. Do you want to come down and see Coldplay? Yeah, we can get you in free. Yeah, fine, we'll have a stroll down. And we sort of wandered down and we actually saw Chris and I think a couple of the other guys walking out of the union. And my mate who had been doing sort of roadieing at the union sort of, hi, Chris. Oh, hello, mate. You're right. And it was like, yeah, there you go. Yeah, we're mates. And I uttered the famous, like, so we saw them and I turned around to myself, yeah, they're pretty good, but they won't get any bigger than this. And then literally within about 3 months, they're like, you know, they're the biggest band in the country. So, yeah. So yeah. It shows what I know about music.
It's so hard to tell. I mean, that's the reality is I don't think anyone, I mean, you couldn't have predicted Oasis even from within the group as it was starting out.
Well, that's interesting.
You know, that's kind of the joy of it.
I had Johnny Sharp on who was Johnny Cigarettes, the NME writer, and he did a scathing review on Oasis, a live review in '93, and just said, you know, that they're awful. And he was saying that McGee, you know, fair play to McGee because he's obviously seen them at that stage. And, you know, with Bonehead with a bit of wispy hair left on his head. And you know what I mean? and said, yeah, this is a really special band, where a lot of people would have just gone, yeah, 5 sort of, you know, pretty quiet Manc blokes hanging around on stage and didn't see it. Whereas McGee saw it, which is phenomenal.
But, it's an amazing skill. I mean, you could argue it was down to the drugs.
Yeah, it could be.
He did whatever it was, he connected with them. I mean, it's amazing. He's... Yeah, you'll enjoy chatting to him later because he's a phenomenon. I mean, he's exactly what, for me anyway, exactly what you hope for.
Yeah.
I've heard all the stories, I've read all the books, and then you meet him. And obviously he's calmed down now, but he's amazing, and he's as razor sharp and hilarious as he ever was.
The band that she brought up in this mad splitter van was Oasis, that they rehearsed in the same rehearsal room as. So it was all really weird, like connected. And they came up, and the King Tut's people weren't going to let them on because they didn't want a 4-band bill. But
they weren't even built to play, were they? Oasis.
No.
They came up on the off chance.
And it was the boyfriend people who had brought Debbie up that were going to sort it out for Oasis. And eventually they were given 4 songs to do. And I, because Glasgow had weird licensing laws, they kept the pubs open to 6 in the morning and then opened them at 9 in the morning. I mean, only in Glasgow. But anyway, you know, like, so the band started at 10:30 I showed up at 8:30 because bands usually used to go on about 9 o'clock, so I would have missed them if it had been usual pub times. And because it was extended hours, I saw the fourth band on the bill, which was Oasis.
But you also, you say in the book, that you helped to get them the gig because the manager of the venue wasn't going to let them play because they weren't billed. And you
I just said, well, why don't you just let them play? I mean, it's easier just to let them play than have a load of angry Manx running about the venue. Do you know what I mean? You know, because they were pretty moody because they were up where they've always had a little firm around them. And there was about, I'd say there was 10 or 12 of them being Manx and all a bit moody, and we let them play. Do you know what I mean? You know.
Yeah, and it's just that passion as well—that passion for music, which is just absolutely brilliant. You know, it's so good that you still got that. It's fantastic.
100%.
Well, you know what, Matt? I'm just going to jump in because you know, when you've got a Twitter followers, you don't actually have to do preparation for interviews, which is brilliant. So I'm just gonna hand it over to them and just fire through. I'm going to read some of these. So so we've got E.M. Ling says, was Paul McGuigan contacted as a participant? And we've got a few of these. You know, where was Gwigsy? We know he's kind of stepped away after leaving the band. What was the negotiations with Gwigs or any discussion about that?
Well, it's funny. So I came on board, I was like, look, well, the very first question I had when I was in that boardroom, I was like, well, look, the elephant in the room is obviously, it's lovely to meet you, Noel. But is Liam on board? And is the rest of the band on board? And I think when we were talking, Marcus was like, look, don't worry about that. We'll deal with all of that. But it was just, you know, it's inevitable years later that they had lots of ups and downs. It got messy. Messier in the period after the section that we were dealing with. But still, you know, that's all the kind of recriminations and people fell out and left and so on. And I said, I really want it to be a film about the band as much as it could possibly can. Of course, a lot of the focus is going to be on the two brothers, but I want it to be about a band. It's like Oasis was a band. It wasn't two people or one person. And so they said, okay, well, look, we'll facilitate that as much as we can, but not everyone's necessarily going to sign up to that. So I think, we sounded out, I mean, what we did, I mean, we'd had to do something similar with Liam, where we were lucky enough that, you know, we'd put the feelers out, but then we had enough friends in common who could vouch for us so that when we actually sat down together, he knew we weren't complete space cadets, or hopefully he did, that sort of thing. And then, similarly with Gwigs, I think Jill Firmanowski, who's this amazing photographer, obviously catalogued a lot of Oasis's and a lot of other bands' highlights. I mean, she's phenomenal. We met her, I think, first, and she still sees Gwigs from time to time, and she lives quite close to him, and they hang out from every so often, I think. And she said, oh, well, I'll mention it to him. And a couple of other people, I think, had done that. And I think in the end, we still hadn't heard anything back, so I believe Simon, again, producer Simon, went over and literally posted a letter underneath his door, what he assumed was Gwigs' door, and was just like, look, we really would love to meet you. And then we did get we got a message back, and I can't quite remember how it happened, but basically I got a message back saying, okay, yeah, sure, he'll go for a pint. I think people seem to have some image of him as some kind of recluse, like he's a kind of hermit who lives in the desert somewhere out in Arizona or something. He's not like that. He lives where he lives. He still lives, you know, in London, and he was so lovely and welcoming. I met his whole family. We went for a drink. We had a lot of chats about the past. He's fascinating. You know, he remembers everything. He's got this insane, almost photographic memory about the past. And he's got a lot of stories. And I was like, look. And he was like, look, I don't really... The past was the past. I just feel like I kind of need to leave it. I've said what I need to... You know, people... that it's moved on without me, and I've had my own life now. I was like, look, I get that. On the other hand... there's a lot of things you're telling me that other people haven't heard. I'd love that to be part of the film. Yeah, it was originally his band. You know, he was the one who had the idea of having a band before he even had an idea of how to pick up a guitar. And so I kind of we ummed and ahed about it. Then we went back. He cooked us dinner. He showed me around. He's got this incredible his life's work for the past kind of 10-20 years seems to have been creating this amazing garden. Like he's one of the world's greatest gardeners. And he's just went out and showed me this beautiful place. And we spent all evening together. I said, come on, you know, there's got to be some way you come round. He was like, look, I'll have a think about it. And I think what it came down to was he fell out with the management. The management, inevitably, of course, they're involved with the film. And I went back a couple of times and I really felt, like he said, like, I think we'll get there. I think I just need to kind of get my head round it. We'll think about it. And then it just didn't work out. He didn't want to do it, which is, of course, completely up to him. But it was a shame because he's got great stories. And you know, his voice should be in there. It was his film. We had bits of archive, which we, you know, a couple of bits we dropped in which he'd, you know, interviews he'd done in the past quite early on. So I felt like I wanted to have him represented in some kind of way. But, you know, he's got a different life now.
Do you still keep in contact with any of the old guys in the band?
Do you know, I've not spoken to Bonehead and Gwiggs since the day that they left, which
how
is...
weird, that's
yeah,
so strange.
It is strange. But I don't... I phoned Gwiggs up in the weeks after he'd... He left by fax, by the way. Yeah. Now, how 80s is that?
What's fax?
Yeah, left by fax. That's... I mean, that's old school, man.
Yeah, seriously.
And I used to call his missus.
Did you have a fax, or was your management company have a fax?
Somebody just showed me the facts, right. You know. I remember phoning his missus, and I knew there was something up when on the third time I'd called, and she said, he's at the shops. And I was like, look, Ruth, I know that boy. Mm. He's too mashed up in his own brain. He's too out of his head to even contemplate going to the shops. Certainly he's not been there 3 days on the spin. Mm. What's he saying? No, he's at the shops, he called me and he gets back, and I was like, you know what, I'll take that as a goodbye then. And that was that.
The same thing with Alan, where I really wanted him to be part of it. Again, we put out the feelers, it sounded all quite positive, and then we kind of got another message back saying no, he wasn't going to be part of the film, which, you know, I don't know all the stories. I've heard all kinds of stories, all contradictory about him and Gwiggs, about how they left and so on. So, you know, he just didn't want to be part of it, which is completely his right. Mm. And then the issue then became that because it was the 90s and because everyone was doing a lot of drugs and it was all a bit chaotic, the paperwork, when you start wanting to use bits of footage, obviously you need their permission. Now, a lot of it is signed off, some of it isn't signed off. And if they don't want to be part of the film, that's up to them. So then you get into real trouble because you're just like, well, in certain territories, it doesn't matter. And you just fair deal it. But, it's, you know, all these kind of things, the thorny issues of making a documentary when you're talking about real lives. And then some of it is like, would you just risk it? But we're not cowboys. And the producers had to take a view. And they were like, look, we just, you know, if you don't have the permission, you can stick it in there. We'll all end up in the High Court. It's not, you know, potentially. Mm. And it's not the right thing to do. If they don't want to be part of the film, that's their lives. That's up to them. So, you know, it's a shame. And I regret it. And I feel like, if we'd had more time, maybe with one or with both of them, we might have managed to get there. But it was such a rush to make the film, and we really tried. I thought we got very close with Gwiggs, but you know, he's an amazing man, and he's got an amazing family and amazing life. So I would love one day, maybe he'll tell his story or he'll write a book. He did say he was thinking about writing a book.
Oh, did he? Okay, all right. No, he's I don't know if you know his sister Mary. But
I don't know her personally. I know of her, yeah.
Yeah, no, because she's on. She's quite active on social media, and so
right.
Yeah, so she's brilliant, and she shared a few things, but as I say, right. I've asked him to come on the podcast. Obviously, it's just, you know, and she said, look, you know, I'll put it to him, but it's not happening. He's not going to do it.
Yeah,
which,
you know, and I can
completely understand that. But I think it's similar to as well. And I was just going to ask you about the choice to sort of not really delve into the rain too much, because I met Chris Hutton this last at Shine On Festival this last week. Oh, you okay there, mate?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, good. So it's just the I think that's okay. Right. There's something else I can do with that.
Yeah, so I met Chris Hutton from the Rain at Shine On Festival, and I'd, you know, and I've asked him to come on. He's just not same thing. Look, it's past. That's my, you know, it's this brief period of my life. I don't really want to focus on it anymore. And you know, to the point where he was happy to chat with me, but wouldn't even record a hello. This is Chris, and you're listening to the Oasis podcast. Right. So, once again, was he contacted, and was that something that you considered, or was it just no? Let's move on to the band.
No, for sure. I mean, we contacted, so I wanted everyone to be in it. And that was part of the problem, is that you have that balance of going, well, you kind of know going in that we were being pushed. The producers were saying that I really feel like it should be a 90-minute film. And we got it to 2 hours in the end at a push. And, you know, because there's all the kind of things about like which cinema chains will show it and so on. And the first cut was epic. It was over 7 hours. And so we had, you know, having said that, it was mostly audio interviews with bits of archive put on top, and then kind of placeholders and bits from films and anything we could throw in there just to kind of bring it to life and try and figure out what the story was. And we put out feelers to all, you know, everyone, you know, from Chris to the real people and they were all brilliant. And we even did some of the interviews. I met and did an interview with Johnny Marr, who was fantastic. And we had, and that was one of the first sequences I cut for the film. Because I edit as well, so I would work in sync with Paul, who was the editor, And so I would cut, I'd take all the best bits, go and write those bits. So the first thing I think I cut was Talk Tonight, and then bless Paul would have to go off and do something else. And then I was like, oh, right, I really want to do the bit with Johnny and talking about the guitar and the whole incident in Newcastle.
Mm.
And it just didn't, you know, we had to squeeze it down. It was like, what do you take out? And the two last things I took out, I think, were with Johnny, that whole Johnny section, which was fantastic about kind of how he mentored Noel and how, and then the history of the guitar that passed from Townsend to Marr to Gallagher. Mm-hmm. And we got smashed over some guy's head. Yeah. I mean, it's like fantastic. That was my favourite bits in the whole film. And similarly with Blur Oasis. I mean, it was a whole 10-minute sequence. And to be honest, I struggled with it a little bit because it's been told so many times. I was like, yeah, but is it?
Right.
It's not very fresh. What can we bring to it? And then McGee was came in and nailed it for us. He was one of the last people we met, and he just was like, look, basically what it is, it's boxing. It's a, you know, you're the heavyweight champion of the world, or champion of UK in the case of Blur. You don't go into the ring with the young upstart, because even if you beat him, and they did, you know, whatever the ins and outs of it, all of which we explored in that sequence, you know, whether they won it, whether they cheated, whether they did this, who motivated, who started it.
Changed the Blur price, changed the date, all that sort of stuff. Yeah,
yeah, they won.
Blur did two Country versions, Oasis did one version, yeah.
Right, but if you're the champion, you don't bring in the upstart, because even if you beat him, then he's now at your level.
Yeah.
So what have you got from it? But if he beats you, then you're really screwed.
Sure.
And what happens in the next fight? And what he was saying, you know, it was the whole kind of, they lost the battle and won the war. So then actually what it comes down to is the next album.
Mm.
And, you know, Oasis had the classic album and Blur didn't quite. I mean, it's a great album, but it's not, it wasn't at that same level.
Yeah.
It wasn't their best. Mm. And so they were primed to take over the world. So I was like, okay, great, that's perfect. Because we're talking about the rise of Oasis, that all makes sense now. And it's got some great quotes in it and it's very funny and all that. And it was just like, do you know what, we can remove that 10 minutes and be at 2 hours. And we're not allowed to be over 2 hours anyway.
Mm.
And it still works as a film. And everyone kind of knows the story. Well, everyone knows the story.
I'd like to thank all the people.
All the people. So many people. And they walk your counted house and it has through their shite life.
In and out. And also, and that was the other reason for the Johnny Marr thing, was like, I kind of said as a mission statement at the beginning, no, this is the story of Oasis, by Oasis, from the inside out.
Yeah.
And Johnny was, you know, was tight with Noel, and he was part of that scene, and he was crucial in encouraging Noel and all those kind of things, but he wasn't part of the band.
Mm.
And so I felt like, okay, we really need to kind of tell it that way around. And so that decided that, even though it was one of my favourite bits in the film. And also, one of the highlights was just getting to meet Johnny and hang out with him for 2 hours. It was amazing.
So this whole film was just an excuse for you to meet Noel Gallagher and Johnny Marr, and basically. Is that what you're telling me?
That's what any of my films would be. That's it. I'm just a complete groupie.
Yeah, exactly. When I look at your filmography, that is basically, it does appear to be the case.
Hang out Andy Serkis.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, it is pretty much shameless.
Yeah, so next up is going to be like some, you know, the story of some supermodel, so you can just hang around with them for a few weeks.
Well, I'd never say no.
Maybe
I think,
not.
But it's funny, isn't it? Because I think you just, as a kid, you kind of have, you know, I always wanted to make films, and you have ideas of the kind of films you might get to make, but I never in a million years imagined I might get to sit down with Noel or with Liam and get to hear their stories. So it's a massive privilege. You know, and then you just have to try and construct it in as best way as you can to try and communicate what that felt like to us just being in the room with them.
Yeah, yeah, sure. No, good. Right, so Stubbsy, who's at Indie Football, said, I was, you know, following on from what you said, really, will any of the footage that wasn't shown in the doc be released at any point? Heard there was hours of footage in and around Nebworth that's just collecting dust somewhere. And why weren't the real people mentioned in the film, considering they were a major influence? And I mean,
the real people were massive.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I interviewed Chris from The Real People, and he explained that, you know, they did this whole interview in their studio, and you know, there's, you know, they've recorded it, I think, in their studio, and it, you know, I think they were quite understandably quite disappointed that they weren't in the film.
I bet. Well, we definitely kind of reached out to everyone at the beginning, and then we interviewed a bunch of people, and then actually there were a lot of other people who Noel had contacted and lined up for us. Like, we were going to interview Johnny Depp, because they were hanging out, they went on holiday just before he started recording Be Here Now, just before Nebworth and so on. So there's all these kind of other, and then Kate Moss and so on, all these other people that we thought, look, this is a kind of fascinating insight into how crazy it got so quickly. But it was just like, I don't want to waste anyone's time. And we were going, look, of course, it'd be great to go over to the States and go and meet Johnny. We're going to go and interview Kate Moss. But I felt like I can't see it surviving. That sequence was brilliant. The whole bit of them going to Mauritius and him knocking out the whole thing and being really disappointed and then coming back and going kind of slightly sheepishly going, well, this is what I've come up with. Everyone going, you're a genius. And him going, well, is it that easy? All of that was brilliant. And it was really, but it just didn't quite fit in the film. And I felt, so for all those reasons, and the same for the real people. I mean, the real people, you only have to look at any of the books to see how crucial they were. And I think they really gave the band confidence, and they were just, and they're fun. Well, their own music is brilliant, and they're just, but they were real, just, I think it was a crucial thing of just them turning up just at the right time and showing Oasis how good they were and how it's shown the potential they had and being enthusiasts and being, I've met a lot of people in my life who are kind of like that they're kind of great facilitators as well as being creative themselves. And so and also they're just mad, and they have all the anecdotes as well of just, all the carnage that was going on while they were there. They like to have a lot of fun. So I think that was great. And it was just, it's just a shame it didn't fit in the film. So yeah. My proposal at the time was like, look, we've got, this is like conservatively, we've got another 5 hours worth of fantastic stuff, but more than that, because we interviewed Mark Coren on a bunch of occasions. He's brilliant. Every word that comes out of his lips is gold. So I was just like, he's got to be in there. We've got to put more of him in there. And it just didn't fit. And so I said, well, can we not create a website or some kind of archive or something so that people, because I think there's a lot of appetite for it. But I just thought, no one was really remotely asked. Really? To quote Noel Gallagher. No one really gave, everyone was just like, mm-hmm. not in a kind of, they were so busy trying to make the film. Everyone was like, well, it's just going to, and I think that there's a lot of eye rolling that goes on, not on this project particularly, but on every project. Because most directors have like lots of different ideas, and we could do this and we could do that. And let's release a 7-hour cut. And everyone's like, okay, 7-hour cut, how are you going to pay for that? And we did, I think there is, just as a way of doing it, I think the way going into it, I think all the interviews kind of belong to the film rather than to me or to anyone else. So they're kind of their own. So I don't quite know how you would unpick all that. I don't, we don't have the right even to, it's not like I could stick it online now. I have asked a couple of times. There's not something we could do, even if we just release it as I think they then kind of cherry picked a couple of bits, for like the Japanese DVD release or something like that. None of it was really controlled by me. This isn't, a kind of diss on anyone else. I was just like, I'm glad it's bits of it are eking out, but I'd love, why don't we just drop the whole thing? So I don't know. It's a kind of, possibly in the future, it all exists. It's all sitting there on hard drive. So I'd like to, if the band were up for it and everyone else was up for it, I'd love to do it, release it in some way. But I don't, it hasn't had much traction. I'm sure there's lots of interest because, there's a lot of fans out there, but it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. Okay. I'm speaking for myself and all the hundreds of people that have sort of basically put the same question together. Yeah, there is definitely, a four disc Blu-ray for £100. You could shift a few copies of it because, that's
I'm the, sure.
It's just a shame. It's a very similar argument to the Beatles in that you've still got the Beatles have got this creative control sort of thing that anything that comes out they want to be the perfect Beatles, Actually the fans and the scholars just say, no, we just want more, and it doesn't need to be the polished version. If they released, 27 takes of Wonderwall or, we would lap them up and analyze every single one, it doesn't have to be the one perfect one at the end, but I can understand how any artist doesn't want that. They want, they don't want people to see those sketches. They want you to see the final finished piece. So I do get that. It's just it's frustrating for us fans, really.
No, of course. And also, like, I think, more than a lot of bands, I think Oasis and Noel and Liam are very conscious of their fans and they're very grateful. That's why that whole end sequence about, it wasn't us, it was the fans. I think that was, it was important to include. And I found it very, it was a very generous kind of warm thing for Noel to say. I think it was the final interview we did, we were just saying, look, it's really not down to us. I thought that was an amazing thing. So they're very conscious of that. I think it's just more, to be honest, they're both so busy with their own things going on and the rest of the guys have all got their own lives. I don't think anyone's really just thinking about it. That's the thing. I think it's, their lives moved on. The film is a very small moment in all of their lives. It just happens to, I think the history of it and what the band meant to people is why it seemed to have captured people's imaginations, why they connected with it. Mm. But I'm sure, you know, in terms of their lives, it was a kind of month or 2 month period where people were suddenly asking all those old questions, but they're busy making new stuff.
Mm. But it's crazy, isn't it? Because we know, you know, there's certain things in your own life that you wouldn't have a clue. Well, was that 2002 or 2003?
Right.
You know what I mean? Whereas actually when it comes to, and we expect musicians to be like, oh yeah, well that was April. And then in the May we did this tour. Well, and also you add in the drugs and alcohol and the sleep deprivation from just not sleeping at all for months on end. It's like, well, you kind of understand that they're not going to know all these things off the top of your head.
Get on the ferry. I don't know how we get on the ferry because we're pissed, but we get on this ferry.
As fate would have it, there was a load of West Ham fans on this overnight ferry. It's got a casino on it and a fucking nightclub.
The Thursday night ferry to the Dam. Who goes to Amsterdam on a ferry for the weekend? What kind of clientele?
The drink of choice for a few hours, champagne and Jack Daniels slammers. The next thing is that sporadic fighting is breaking out all around us, really. Liam is very excited by the prospects of a lot of chaos going on, and he goes and joins in.
Yeah, it was fucking mayhem, man. I loved it.
You can see him running through the windows along the deck. He's having a great time. He looks like he's in a school playground chasing leaves.
Liam at one point said they ran through a casino and he flung all the roulette shit off the table as he was running past.
Then as a fight broke out, and all I remember was it was a bit Benny Hill.
The next time I see him, he's still running, but he's got policemen running after him.
Someone's punched someone, someone's kicked someone, someone's got nicked, and then we're handcuffed, sent down to the bottom of the boat. We get locked up.
Woke up next day, and I spoke to the customs, and I said, look, you know, I'm kind of missing four people. Do you know where they are?
We were heading back, not having any money. Couldn't phone anyone, couldn't do nothing.
I can remember getting to the hotel and having to ring Marcus and Alec, and they're going, you fucking what? You what?
And he says, you've fucking blown it, you've blown it.
But that was pulled up, man. Management, fuck them. Never listen to a word them clowns said anyway, you know what I mean?
I call McGee, and I'll never forget this, and this is another reason why I love McGee. I said, are you sitting down? I've got some news. Everybody's been arrested. The only word he said was, brilliant.
A hell of a start, that, innit? That's great first day at work. Love it.
But was that quite difficult when you're doing the interviews if people are saying something, you're like, well, actually, that's not correct, and we've got sort of evidence here to confirm it wasn't?
Yeah, I mean, that was part of the fun, I think, because they were, it wasn't like they were going in with some kind of polished version of, like, this is how, you know, my legacy, this is what I want people to believe, or they were quite the opposite. I think what Noel had said privately to Simon before we started was, he was like, look, I've got great kind of 30-second, one-minute versions of these that I can tell, you know, if I'm propping up a bar or if I'm on TV, you go, all right, tell me about Whiskey A Go Go. Boom, right, here you go. And he said, I've no idea if they're true or not. I want this. I don't want this just to be the kind of pat version that everyone's heard before. And the great thing was, obviously, we had just about enough time to really dig in and hear all the different kind of versions of events, like whether just reading them or listening to old interviews or, you know, speaking to different people. So that actually when we did sit down with Noel and Liam particularly, but with everyone else, I could go, you know, they'd start going one way and I'd go, and I'd let them finish, obviously, and go, okay, great, so we've got that version. That's the kind of, that's the varnished version. And now, actually, what about this photo? Or look, here's the original footage that someone's found. Or what about this? You know, or Liam said this last week. And create more of a conversation. I mean, you know, exactly like you say, no one can remember exactly what was happening 20, 21, 22, 23 years ago.
Mm.
And that's part of the fun of it. It's kind of, and that's one of the reasons why we decided to do it as a kind of audio thing, was like, well, let's create a conversation between these people, even though two of them will never, or more will never sit inside the same recording booth again. At the very least, we can kind of make it feel like they're talking to each other. Yeah. And what was lovely about them is they were generous enough to keep on coming back. So Noel said, and Liam said the same thing, as many times as you need me, I'll be there. So we kind of alternated weeks, or sometimes had the two of them coming in on different days on the same week. And so I'd say, oh, you know, and they would ask, well, what's he been saying this time? Like, okay, well, he said this. Oh, hang on. No, it wasn't like that at all. And it was great, because then you could just get into a kind of controlled conversation back and forth via us.
And you never tried to pull a fast one, like, you know, in romantic comedies when they arrange to meet, you know, they arrange to meet the boy and the girl at the same time and then say, oh, actually, now we're going to lock you in the room together. You never fancy trying to pull that trick?
Yeah, well, we almost had the same, because it's slightly tricky, because you had certain people who probably didn't necessarily want to see it. We kind of took it for granted that they didn't necessarily want to bump into each other. But schedule-wise, you're going, okay, well, they need to come in. Also, just other things, like you knew that if Bonehead was coming in on the same time as Liam and we had another interview scheduled with Bonehead the next morning, the second interview wasn't going to happen because they'd be out all night. Because they're very bad influence on each other. There was a little bit of kind of like, let's please make sure they don't overlap. But yeah, no, we didn't decide to pull a fast one. We were like just terrified we might have double booked, done one of those ones where they both turn up. That would have been wouldn't have been fun.
A couple of people asked about the parents, both. So Terry Appleby said, did you ever consider contacting Tommy Gallagher for any input? And also, I can't remember who now, but someone said that apparently you've said before that Peggy gave you hours and hours of great stuff. And here we go. It was Chris Park. Matt said he had so much content from Peggy, he could have made a film just about her. Was there anything she mentioned that was a standout that didn't make the documentary because it was irrelevant to the narrative you were following?
Well, it's funny. I only met Peggy once. So we went and spent 3 hours with her one day over at her house. And she was amazing. And it was great. I could have sat there for weeks just listening to all her stories. And what happened was, I didn't really know the shape of the thing going in. I had a vague idea that, I was like, is it going to be chronological? Is it going to start with Noel talking about being born? Is it going to start with, I've no idea. Mm. And then, so I went over with Simon to go and meet Peggy. And we started talking, and she's, what really struck a chord for me particularly was, so my parents were refugees coming over to England, and so I was like, she started talking about the whole experience of being 17, I think, and coming over from Ireland and her upbringing there, and the fact that they slept 5 to a bed and all these amazing things, and the incredible perseverance she had and the courage to come over and start a life over here, and then to meet someone and start a family, and then all the problems that came after. So I thought that was amazing. That's a whole film in itself. And so, but, you know, not at the beginning, you're not worried about creating something that's too long. So we had about a 10-minute sequence, which was just Peggy's story about how she grew up. And then the archivists had found some really beautiful footage, obviously not of her. We had a couple of photos, but just footage of, you know, growing up, working class, very poor in Ireland. I was like, this is great. We put it all over what she said, put some music underneath. I was like, this is amazing. This is the best bit in the film. But then I was like, well, hang on. I mean, with the best will in the world, people aren't going to sit through 12 minutes of Peggy Gallagher talking about growing up in Ireland if they've come to see Oasis.
Yeah.
And I loved it. And then we had it, and then we tried it in different bits. And then in the end, we kind of had like, just there's a moment of it that's probably lasts about 35 seconds or something like that in the film that survived. But it was one of my favourite bits because they used to walk to school. They had one pair of boots between the whole 7 kids, so they'd take turns on who would get to wear it. The rest of them would be barefoot going to school. I mean, it was absolutely incredible. Again, another bit that would be, if she approved it, I'd love people to hear because it was really great. The issue is, obviously, I think you can only really do the audio because we had this amazing footage, which is massively expensive. We had beautiful music underneath, which would have to be composed, or, you know, so it wouldn't be what we'd put together. But still, just her voice on its own is incredibly compelling. Yeah, so there was all that section. There was another thing which was, you know, just Noel talking about growing up and being a kid, and then Liam kind of chipping in, and it was really good. It was some of my favourite bits, but it didn't quite sit in the two. You know, you have to sacrifice something, otherwise you've got a 14-hour odyssey epic on your hands, which no one necessarily wants to sit, apart from a very few people want to sit down and watch.
He used to kill Noel. Noel was the one that got it the most. I remember Noel once saying, if you don't get out of here, Mum, and leave him, he says, I'm going to kill him. And I thought, oh, Jesus, you can't be doing time for the likes of him.
Yeah, my dad used to beat the living daylights out of me. I've never felt compelled to either talk about it or write about it. I know that I think it's no one else's business. You can't let that kind of thing affect you in any way, because then you're carrying that weight all the way through life.
He always thought you'd never leave him because you'd know where to go to. You'll never leave me, yes, it won't I? Try it. One night, we got the courage to get out, and I left him a knife and a fork and a spoon, and I think I left him too much.
Well, he never once come after us. Wasn't there. It's a sense of, see you later, we're free.
It definitely affected them because they got very bitter.
I wouldn't say I was scarred, but everybody's childhood makes them what they are. You can't think about it too deeply because it would fucking drive you mad. I think it benefited me in the way that it made me withdraw into my own world, and from that came the learning to play the guitar. I guess in some way, my old fella beat the talent into me.
Yeah. Well, I think it then becomes like, yeah, the Oasis anthology, doesn't it, over, you know, over
right.
10 episodes or something. I mean, well, look, Netflix, yeah. You know, there you go. Netflix might buy it and stick it.
I would have been up for it. Well, no, good. I mean, great. Like, if anyone was up for it, I mean, the thing actually kind of exists in some slightly embryonic form. So it's not, I'm not averse to it. I just don't quite know how you pull it together. Mm. But maybe one day if there's enough interest.
That'd be amazing. There's a, a question Dan Best asked, Dan Best 84, which really stuck out to me at the same time as well. And I don't know how you did this with certain bits of footage. There's a scene where Paul Gallagher answers the phone in the house. And I think it's the, I can't remember, is it McGee's on the line or something? Or and it's
oh, Noel. It's Noel calling, that's to talk it. To Liam. Yeah.
And how did you get that? Like, where's that, you know, was there answering machine phone tapes kept or something? You know, and when you did you just get this, like, bags of stuff and just think, God, this is just gold?
We got some stuff which was gold. And we got other bits which had kind of been promised to us. There was something in The Sun years ago which was supposed to be, which probably must exist somewhere, of Liam on stage at primary school and some nativity play or something, which, again, when in their heyday, The Sun had splashed it all over the front pages saying you can ring up this number and you can hear him singing for the first, whatever, all this sort of thing, which we tried to track down. We spoke to his primary school. Someone went there, met one of the teachers. Oh, yeah, there is a tape knocking around. I don't, you know, all that sort of thing. And so there were a lot of false leads, a lot of things that were like, a lot of kind of wild goose chases on the way. And then the odd bit of stuff came up that was the real thing. I mean, the amazing, yeah, some of the footage with the Inspirals, which is amazing that they gave us of him on tour. That all that stuff was nuts and amazingly generous of them to share with us. And that was real gold. But then other bits where you're like, look, we've got in that 7-hour cut, or however long it was, we'd have these chunks where you have a fantastic story, five people talking about something brilliant and nothing to show for it. And it's like, what do we do with it? And we had different ideas. And one of the first things that happened was the guys who do our visual effects, this company called The Brewery, Mark, who's a mate of mine, just came over and said, well, what is it you want? And I said, well, I'm not really sure. When he came, he was looking and we had all these tons of old NMEs and photos and Jill's pictures that she'd lent us and all scattered over the desk as I was going through them all. And he was like, well, maybe we could kind of do a top shot of this and you kind of going. So that was one of the things. We were like, well, maybe we kind of see evidence of our research and then you drift in and out of it. That could be something. And it could have the kind of collage-y, cut-out, kind of lo-fi punk thing that Liam and Noel quite like. And then the other thing was like, okay, well, there's sequences here, like, for example, talking about that phone call of him ringing back and say and going to that first gig, because I think, you know, a lot of people, obviously fans know, but people who don't know the band or only know the songs won't know that it wasn't Noel's. You'd assume it was Noel's band from the beginning, and obviously it wasn't. And the fact that it was Liam who wasn't even into music and then suddenly was into music, it was a shock even to Noel. So I think, so how do we illustrate that? That's got to be in the film, but we didn't have anything to show for it. But I think Fiona, who was one of the other producers, was like, look, why can't you just use stuff from later on and just play around with it, see if you can get the lips to sync. I was like, really? Are we allowed to do that? Okay, fine. We sort of tried it. And weirdly, because I suppose this is a trick your mind plays on you, that you want to, if you see someone talking and you can hear them talking, then you assume that they're talking in sync. And with a bit of shifting around and clever editing, you can kind of slow it down and speed it up and try and more or less get it in sync, and you just assume you're seeing and hearing the same thing. So there was footage of Noel on the phone to someone
right
later on, so like it must have been about a year later, and we had that a couple of years later because they spent a long time rehearsing, and so we'd had that from some documentary that someone was making once they were on the rise, and so we just switched them around. And that to me, that I felt, oh, that's right. So it was Paul answering the phone, and then it was Noel a couple of years on, you know, just having another conversation being okay. filmed by Jill. And so we kind of cobbled the two things together. And I was like, well, we'll keep it as a kind of placeholder until we find the real footage or we find another way of illustrating it. And then I kind of liked it because there's something tongue in cheek about the way that the Gallaghers tell their stories anyway.
Exactly.
And I thought it's a bit cheeky and kind of in your face. I'm assuming that people won't think it's real. But then the funny thing is, when we showed it to Liam, he was like, "Where'd you get that footage from?" And then most people seemed to think it was real. I was like, "No, none of it's. We didn't have a camera crew filming you from birth."
Yeah, I know.
But, you know, that's just the power of film, isn't it?
But I love it because, like you say, it's rock and roll is myth, right? And that's what we don't care. We're happy for her to have a bit of artifice, and especially the way the film is put together with the, with the collages and the animation and stuff. It's fine. Right. This isn't the dry, documentary. This is a fun, and that was the band at that point. It was fun and exciting and vibrant and crazy, and you have to capture that. I think you've done that, really well. And so something like that was just really good fun.
That's the thing. I think it's interesting when I've done it in the past with more serious subject matter. We did a film years ago called Road to Guantanamo, and again, we have you hit, and I'm doing a film for the BBC at the moment about the Bauhaus art school, art movement, and it depends on the how you handle it and how honest you are about it and how in your face. I mean, I think if you're showing a piece of footage and you assume the audience is going to think, hang on, that's real, then that's slightly different, particularly if you're dealing with politics and so on. I mean, there was the whole hoo-ha about the Queen walking the wrong way. Do you remember when they had that documentary about the Queen? It was like a kind of a year in the life of the Queen or something, and then in the trailer, poor BBC, which was the battering ram of the butt of so many people from either side, and they'd stuck it in. Whoever put the teaser trailer together had like an argument or something. Her looking a bit awkward and seeming to storm out of an interview, and she wasn't storming out; she was storming in because she was in a rush or something.
Yeah.
There is, I take the point. And I remember when we were doing Road to Guantanamo, there was a similar thing about like, well, hang on, you're interviewing them. Can't you interview the people who they're claiming to be tortured? Can't you interview the torturer as well? And I was like, in that case, we've talked about it. It's like, no, I don't. And I feel the same with Tommy Gallagher. I feel like I don't really, someone can go off and make a film about him. I feel like there's enough people who can corroborate the things that he did, the terrible things he did. I don't really feel like I need to listen to him justify himself. There's been enough of that in the press.
No,
and he's enough of an opportunist that I thought he could use it in the wrong way. So I didn't feel comfortable about that. Mm. And similarly, I didn't really want to interview torturers talking about enhanced interrogation techniques in Road to Guantanamo. It's like, I don't want to hear from them. I want to hear about the people they hurt. But it's a tricky thing to do in documentary, because you need to assume a level of intelligence on the part of the audience, but also you can't mislead people in the wrong way. No. But this was just fun, I think.
No, I get that. One of the things that Darian Cruz, Stella Caster, asked, and this is something I mentioned when I interviewed Tony McCarroll, having knowing Tony's book quite well, it felt quite whether it's a coincidence or whether you kind of use that as a template, it really did feel like chapter one, chapter two, chapter three tended to hit exactly the same points as Tony McCarroll's book. Was that just a pure coincidence that those were the big and most interesting things, or was that kind of used as a bit of a template?
It was one of the first books I read, definitely. And I think it's a great book. I'm sure, there's kind of 10 important books about Oasis. So obviously, the first thing we did was read them all and then just do a kind of a chart on the wall and go, okay, here are the bits in. No idea whether they're real or not, because everyone's got conflicting stories, but these are the ones we want to talk about. And Tony was one of the first people who came in, and it was lovely, again, talking about people who've been kind of damaged by their time with the band. I mean, I think, he had a very rough treatment, which we deal with in the film, and which the band kind of acknowledge. But on the other hand, it's like, well, they were, I think Noel will be the first to acknowledge he's kind of ruthless in his pursuit of being the best band in the world, and he considered that he didn't want Tony to be in it anymore. So I think it's tricky. You kind of hear it from both sides. And he was actually, it's funny, because his first thing with Tony would be that he'd be very flip and be like, kind of say whatever, he'd be very dismissive. And then he'll go, well, look, he's a lovely guy, but that's not what rock and roll is about. And then he'll kind of reconsider it and go, well, maybe I just didn't like him. And then so those kind of things. And similarly with Tony would, I think he was hurt by that time. Mm. He would love to kind of relive it again and stay on. And I'm sure, he did wind people up, and you can see it in his book and you can see it in the other books and so on. It's like there was a lot of friction. Yeah. And also it's the classic thing in every single band, from Pete Best to Will Champion and Coldplay to Tony, is like every single drummer, because it's the most fundamental thing that keeps the whole band together. That's the kind of the engine room of any band, and it's the first thing you notice when it doesn't work. And most drummers are going in with a level of proficiency probably about the same as the singer and the guitarist and everything else, but they're the ones that get the stick because they have to get the stick. They get it in the neck because it doesn't actually. It's not, you know, you notice when it's wrong immediately. So that's happened with most bands, isn't it? So I feel bad for him in that sense, and I think his thing was like, if they just give me one more chance. But then depending on who you speak to, he had a million and one chances. But I thought his book was amazing.
The mad thing was, you know, having watched Supersonic, I was like, hold on a minute, have they literally taken the chapters from your book? Yes. You see what I mean? Yeah. It was like.
Well, I was probably the only one who had a memory. Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
But so I wonder really if they. I wonder if he used. I'm actually getting Matt Whitecross on in a bit, and
yeah.
I'm going to ask that because it really does feel like, you know, they do a big section on the Whiskey A Go Go gig. You do, yeah. You know, and it's like, well, hold on a minute, that's bloody. I mean, they are, yeah, fine, they're key moments, but it does feel very close to your. It basically being the film of your book.
You know, I'm not the only. I didn't say it, but a lot of people have approached me and said, no way, you know, they picked that from your book. I'm like, it can be too detailed if you like to deny it. Yeah,
it seems very close.
So we had that then as a template, and then not just kind of as the uniquely as a template, but we had it as one of the things that we drew on. Mm-hmm. And I think he's actually, and bless him, I mean, you know, we had a much longer Tony section in there, which was more nuanced, and it had people talking about, you know, we had Mark Collis said something brilliant, and he was kind of saying, you know, I think he mentions it still in the film, but it was much longer, and he said, like, I really regret, and I think a lot of us regret the way that Tony was treated and so on. And so I that was one of the last things, again, that I pulled out, because I was like, we just don't have time for it, but it's important, because it's important to acknowledge that it was very messy, but it wasn't just a to do with musical skill, there was just a friction of personalities.
So I definitely
that was one of the first books we read. And also, and then Tony, I think at the moment he's going around doing a tour, possibly showing the film as well and talking about, you know, and so it's like, good luck to him. And and what was lovely was that he came along to the Manchester premiere with his family, and then he got to spend the evening with Liam and hanging out and kind of talking about the past. I think that meant quite a lot to him. So,
which,
you know,
he talked about with me.
He's a good guy.
So, yeah, no, that, right. That was really lovely to hear. That really did mean a lot to him. And that was thanks to you, because that, you know, you doing this put that made that happen. So, you know, it's good. It's good.
Oh, sweet. Well, yeah, no, he's. I mean, you know, I think a lot of people might have just, you know, like, I've no idea exactly what's gone on with everyone else, but I think a lot of people might have just been like, do you know what, that was then. I don't want to talk about it anymore. And sure. You know, bless him for agreeing to trust us and take part. Because that's the other thing. It's like, you do an interview and we talk for 3 hours or 4 hours or whatever it was, and then we use, what, probably like 3 or 4 minutes of it in the whole film.
Yeah.
And we've been very selective. And it wasn't because we might have been trying to stitch him up if we wanted to. So we deliberately tried to be within the time we had as kind of honest and as open, and also just hear from everyone. Sure. On each side. But I that was one of the things I regretted, is there wasn't more Tony in the film, because he was really good and he gave us a great interview. And that inevitably is much more nuanced. That whole, whatever, everything that happened with him and him leaving is much more nuanced than we had time for in the film.
Cool. Good. I'm going to need to put a pin in that here, Max. I need to leg
it. You've got
to go. Yeah, I do need to run. But thank you so much for your time. And it'd be great. We'll put this up, and I'm sure we'll come back and maybe do it again because there's still probably 100 questions we didn't get to.
Anytime. No worries.
That'd be brilliant. So we'll definitely do a part two. But for now, Matt, thank you so much for your time. And all the best.
Pleasure. Thanks so much. Cheers. Have fun with Alan.
All right, bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Appalling. Every member of the crew, every member of the fucking band, because of crystal meth.
Phil Smith, our roadie, was responsible for putting the set lists out. For some reason, my set list was different to everybody else's.
They were all playing different songs at the same time. Whoa, what's going on here?
It was a shambles, man. It was an absolute fucking shambles.
So thank you very much to Matt Whitecross. Absolutely brilliant to talk to him, and I hope you guys enjoyed that. Any feedback, do please get in touch. As you know, my favourite thing is an audio message. Get a smartphone, iPad or whatever, get audio memos or voice memos, hit record, say what you want to say, fire it over to me, and as long as it's interesting, I'll probably play it on the podcast. So if there's any more questions for Matt, or if any feedback, or if you still want to have a go at me for saying I didn't like Columbia, then do feel free to get in touch. Which is what these people have done. So first up, it is Robert Fan from Brazil.
Hi, my name is Robert Fan. I'm an Oasis podcast listener from São Paulo, Brazil. I would like to thank James and all the interview with at the Oasis podcast for teaching me new aspects of Oasis that I had never heard before, and for making my passion for the band even stronger than ever. Thank you very much. I appreciate you guys.
Robert, thank you very much for that. Much appreciated. And the tenors in the post. That's brilliant. And if you're in other countries, I do really love to hear from you. So that's brilliant. Right. Who else is next? Aha. This is the author, Tim Woods.
Hi, James. It's Tim Woods here in Berlin. Just dropping you a message to say how much I enjoyed the recent episode on Definitely Maybe. I can't say I agree about Columbia. It's one of my favourite tracks, I've got to be honest. But I did think he had a point about it not really fitting with the rest of the album. It's definitely got a different kind of groove. And yeah, I only really noticed that after you pointed it out. I was also interested by what you were saying about the comparison between Married with Children and Her Majesty. It's a little kind of throw-in track at the end, something to finish off the album. So yeah, that was interesting too.
Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she doesn't have a lot to say. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she changes from day to day. I wanna tell her that I love her a lot, but I gotta get a belly full of wine. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, someday I'm gonna make her mine, oh yeah. Someday I'm gonna make her mine.
There's no need for you to say you're sorry. Goodbye, I'm going home. I don't care no more, so don't you worry. Goodbye, I'm going home.
I'm looking forward to the chat about Bonehead's Bank Holiday. That's not a track I know so well, so it'll be interesting to hear your thoughts on that one. And while I'm here, I thought I'd just give my Britpop themed novel a bit of a plug as well. It's called Love in the Time of Britpop, and while it's not exclusively about Oasis, they feature in it quite heavily, as you'd imagine. So listeners to the pod who are fans of the band and of Britpop in general might enjoy it. It's available online. You can just Google for the title and it should come up. And it's I guess it's a little bit like High Fidelity without being quite so successful in terms of sales. But thanks again. Yeah, I've been enjoying catching up on the podcast and looking forward to the forthcoming ones as well. Cheers.
Thank you very much to Tim for that. That is brilliant. And make sure you check out Tim's book, Love in the Time of Britpop. I've been starting to give that a read, and it is a really good piece of work. Very reminiscent of the 90s and with all those references and stuff. So it is really good. And if you go to the notes of this podcast, then you can find a link to go and buy it if you want. Right, next up, let's cross stateside. Here is our good friend, Grandpa Batman.
Hey JC and fellow listeners of the Oasis podcast, this is your friend Grandpa Batman from the Batforce Radio podcast, and I wanted to give an additional fan reaction to the recent A to Z review of I've Got the Fever. I first heard it as part of the bonus interview that you put out for our mutual friend Brandon Aaron for his cancer charity, and I enjoyed it then, and I'm glad that you put it out on the regular public podcast so that more listeners could hear that review. It's one of my favorite B-side songs, and I thought you guys did a great job breaking it down. I learned a lot, and it was fun hearing others give their opinion and some insight to the song as well. One of the things that you guys touched on was not always being able to clearly hear Liam's lyrics in this song, and I totally agree, especially in the verse part. You know, there's that line that he sings, "I can feel it coming in the air tonight," and the next line, a lot of people sing it as, "And I know, I know, I know," but I swear I hear him say, "I can feel it coming in the air tonight, and I know I'm not alone." And then the next line is the one that throws everyone off, and there's a lot of debate about what it is. If you Google the lyrics, it's written as, "Swear I heard a song on the radio, my heart is laughing back at me." But in my ear, I swear I hear the word "my" in front of radio. And over the last couple of days, I've been listening to the track more and more, and I hear him say different things. And it's, you know, it's up to your interpretation what he says there. Does he say, "Swear I heard my song on the radio"? "Swear I heard a song on the radio"? "Sweating out my soul on the radio"? "Swear I'm a song on the radio. I don't know. It's one of those phrases that he just kind of barked it out. And I'm sure Noel was like, "That'll do," because he did the rest of the take so well that, you know, it'd be difficult to just go in and punch in that one line. I've worked with singers in the studio before, and sometimes it's just difficult to get them to convey either the lyrics or the expression that you're wanting, either as the producer or the songwriter. And sometimes you're just like, you know what, that's it, that's the take, and we'll just bring the instruments up to a volume right there and just kind of mask it. But that's just Liam, and that's kind of the beauty of the song, is that, you know, the lyrics are so vague and ambiguous, you can put in your own little interpretation, sing it how you want. I'd like to know what some of the tribute band singers, what lyrics they use. I don't think I've ever seen a tribute band do this song. So if they do, please get in touch with the podcast and let us know so we can see some live footage. There was some discussion on what the song was about. Being that it was written during the heyday of the Oasis popularity and the Be Here Now era, where everything was overdone, and, you know, the party lifestyle where everything and anything was accessible, it could have been written as an admission by Noel saying, "Yeah, this is a little out of control. It's fun, but, you know, it's got me on my knees. There's a breaking point." This is just my interpretation. It's just the way I've always seen it. Not that it's right. It's just, you know, based on a lot of listening to their music, reading books published about them, seeing who they're influenced by, seeing where they grew up and those circumstances. So that's the way I've always interpreted it. It sounds like swampy blues type of song with a little bit of a dark underlying theme. But anyway, that's my two senile cents. Wanted to thank you again for doing the great job that you're doing and bringing the worldwide community of Oasis listeners closer together. I'm actually working on some of the tracks with Brandon for his album. Since he spoke to you last, I met up with him in Los Angeles, and we had a good meeting, and now we're just trying to collaborate a little bit, you know, across the country on some of the songs. He's written some really good songs. I can't wait for you guys to hear these. So I'm going to be trying to do my best to add a little bit of what I do on top of them, and hopefully the Oasis podcast will be the first place to hear some of this music. Cheers, guys.
Thank you, Gramps. Greatly appreciated as ever. Yeah, interesting one. What does he say in those lyrics? It's hard to say. And whatever Noel wrote down, well, it's not necessarily what Liam sang. So I think it is sweating out my soul on the radio. Or it could be swear I heard a soul on the radio. Don't know. Very interesting. But yes, anyway, thank you, Grandpa Batman. And he also mentioned there about Brandon Arend. Now, Brandon, if you remember, he was the guy that survived cancer. We did the big episode a year or so ago where we found out all about that story. And if you haven't heard that, then make sure you go back and check that out, because it's an absolutely brilliant one. And he has slowly but surely been putting together an album based on songs that he wrote when he was suffering from cancer. But I think it's quite upbeat. That makes it sound really sad, but I think it is a really upbeat album. And he's putting together at the moment, and he has sent me over a couple of bits. One of them is a video he's put together of a tune that we first played on the podcast, well over a year ago, by his band Delta, called Fully Loaded. So I played it on here before, and it's a really great tune. So go and check that out on YouTube. But what I wanted to just drop into you here is he's put together, there's a song that's going to be on that album called Copper Country. Yeah, and so what he's put together is quite cool. It's like a progression of how the song has been coming together. And it kind of tells the story of what's been going on over there, him putting this together. And it sounds really interesting. So let's have a little bit of Copper Country.
As soon as I feel the rasp, I know I'm there.
Two.
So thank you very much to Brandon for doing that. Greatly appreciated, and we will stay in touch with him. And yeah, hopefully speak to him again soon, find out what's going on, and might get him to do another A to Z, because he's very entertaining. Right, so I think that will do it for today. Next week, just a little one, you might have heard of him, Alan McGee. So make sure you stay in touch for that. Thank you for listening to the Oasis podcast. A special thanks to patrons. You know who you are. You put your money where your mouth is, and it's greatly appreciated. You too can become a patron and support the show at patreon.com/oasispod. And I am tending to put up these episodes early. So this one with Matt Whitecross has been up for about a week. You could have heard it early. So the same will be for McGee. That will be coming very shortly on Patreon. So if you want to go and sign up there from $1 per month, that will qualify you to hear those early episodes. Do follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Oasis Podcast. Emails and audio messages, please send over to oasispod@gmail.com. You can get t-shirts and other merch with the podcast logo at TeePublic. please subscribe and review on iTunes, and come and see us live, Water Rats, May 17th, London King's Cross. Tony McCarroll, live music, live DJs. It's going to be amazing. As ever, stay in touch, stay engaged, and stay young.
What is going on in this room now? Can walk next door to boys' home, yeah? Go in there and be like,
hey, fuck.
Oh, Jesus Christ, this fucking, we've got to get this fucking thing together now, because, like, it's not in time. And, like, if it's not in time, this fucking mean you're going, like, hey. You go in there, Dave, and it's like, well, hey, come on, hey. Like, but you come in this room, and it's like, you know, it's the funny farm. And that's what it's all about. It's like, do what you friggin' want. If you want to go, like, that, do it, because it don't mean nothing. If you want to go, oh, do that. If you want to go, hey, fuck, man. Hey, fuck, like, you do that. But if you want to just do this, what I'm doing here now, just do it, like, because it's like, right?
This is an advert for not taking drugs.
No, this is an advert.
This is an advert. It's not getting into chemical abuse big time.
Hey, people who know that I have not been a fucking, I've never been an abuser. No one's, I've never been an abuser, I've been a user. I've never been an abuser, man. And they know, what's it doing? Drugs, do the air, man. The air, man. Music. And that is it, and that is it, and I'm ranting now.